Hello, and welcome to our program. My name is Alan Lai, and I will be reading from the Sporting News here on Sight into Sound Radio. This week, we'll start with college football. In an article by Bill Bender, Bill Belichick grades North Carolina debut a total failure against TCU after opening drive. How do you grade the greatest NFL coach of all time based on his college debut? This is the challenge with North Carolina's Bill Belichick, a six-time Super Bowl winner whose debut went off script after the first series. TCU routed North Carolina 48-14, which exposed the challenge of coaching a roster with 70 new players from the transfer portal. Belichick's arrival generated over-the-top hype on Labor Day. There was a North Carolina GOAT collection in attendance that included Michael Jordan, Lawrence Taylor, Roy Williams, and Mia Hamm. Jordan Hudson, Belichick's girlfriend, was spotted in a suite with NFL legend Randy Moss, who played for Belichick in New England. TCU, a legit Big 12 championship contender with Sonny Dykes, spoiled the debut. The Horned Frogs lost 45-42 to Colorado in Deion Sanders' debut on September 2, 2023. That would not happen here. Chapel Bill has a lot of work to do with North Carolina, and it showed. Here are our grades for Belichick in his debut. Bill Belichick pregame interview. A. Remember the warm and cordial Belichick from ACC kickoff? Yeah, that guy is gone, replaced by the cursory answers made famous during his tenure with New England. ESPN sideline reporter Holly Rowe pointed out Belichick made his college debut 35 years to the day of his first game as a NFL head coach with the Cleveland Browns. I hope it goes better than the game against Jimmy Johnson in Dallas, Belichick said. They crushed us, so hope it goes better than that. The Cowboys won that game 26-14, and it was a one-score game in the fourth quarter. This was much worse. Belichick was also asked about the sweatshirt with the cut-off sleeves. Yeah, it's kind of my thing. This still is our favorite version of Belichick. Bill Belichick's North Carolina offense. F. North Carolina opened the game with a 7-play, 83-yard TD drive that was a perfect mix of run and pass with new quarterback Gio Lopez. He hit Jordan Shipp on a 39-yard corner route and a 19-yard pass on a run-pass option. Caleb Hood capped that with an 8-yard TD run. Freddie Kitchens, the former Cleveland Brown head coach in 2019, was dialed in on the first drive, but the Tar Heels were a disaster after the script. Lopez did not complete another pass until there was 8:10 left in the third quarter. North Carolina's next three drives amounted to 9 plays for a minus 10 yards. The Tar Heels were 0-5 on third down in the first half. Lopez made the first critical mistake with 3:57 left in the first half. On third and four, Lopez tried to throw an out route, but TCU safety Bud Clark jumped the route for a 25-yard interception return for a TD. That gave the Horned Frogs a 17-7 lead. Once the Tar Heels fell behind 34-7, Lopez fumbled on a sack, which was picked up by Devin Deal and returned 31 yards for a touchdown. That was 2 turnovers that led to 14 points for TCU. Belichick loves to say, "You can't win until you keep from losing." That second defensive TD emptied the stands. A bright spot, Max Johnson, a sixth-year player who played 2 seasons at Texas A&M and LSU, replaced Lopez in the third quarter. He led a TD drive with a 2-yard TD pass to his brother Jake Johnson with 9 seconds remaining in the third quarter. Johnson finished 9 of 11 passing with 103 yards and a TD. Lopez finished 4 of 10 for 69 yards with an interception and a fumble. The Tar Heels had 50 rushing yards and finished 1 of 10 on third down. Bill Belichick's North Carolina defense, D. Defensive coordinator Steve Belichick made it work on the first drive, too, but the Horned Frogs settled in with a six-play, 58-yard drive on their second series. Josh Hoover hit Jordan Dwyer for a 27-yard TD with 4:08 left in the first quarter. A pass interference call helped set that score up. Hoover hit 20 of 25 passes for 193 yards in the first half, with the lone mistake and interception by Caleb Cost on a tipped pass. Tar Heels defensive back Caleb Cost stopped the next TCU drive with an interception with 5:13 remaining in the first half. Kyle Lemmerman added a 33-yard field goal as time expired in the first half for a 20-7 lead. The Tar Heels, however, did not make the right halftime adjustments. Kavorian Barnes opened the second half with a 75-yard TD run on the first play from scrimmage. On the next drive, Hoover connected with tight end Chase Curtis for a 21-yard gain on 3rd-and-20, and Trenton Battle scored on a 28-yard TD run. Missed tackles were an issue in the second half. Hoover finished 27 of 36 for 284 yards. TCU finished with 258 rushing yards on 7.4 yards per carry. Bill Belichick North Carolina special teams. C. Special teams are Belichick's specialty. North Carolina punter Tom Magnus dropped a punt snap late in the first half, but he recovered for a 26-yard punt. Magnus averaged 39 yards per punt, and returners Chris Culliver and Jalen McGill averaged 21 yards per return. North Carolina did not make any game-altering plays on special teams. Where does Bill Belichick and UNC go after the Week 1 blowout? We're on to Charlotte. Belichick's arrival created a buzz, but the blowout loss showed how difficult the job will be in year one. Three turnovers, one of which were returned for touchdowns, did not help. The Tar Heels might have a quarterback controversy with Lopez and Johnson, and the inability to win third down was a killer for the Tar Heels in this loss. North Carolina faces Charlotte and Richmond the next 2 weeks before its next swing against a Power 4 school at UCF on September 20th. Belichick will not have another spotlight game until Clemson visits North Carolina on October 4th. How much will the Tar Heels improve in that stretch? In another story by Bill Bender, College Football Week 1 Overreactions. Kalen DeBoer is done at Alabama, Arch Manning is overhyped, and more. Will Alabama fire Kalen DeBoer after this season? We'll know the moment there was no turning back if they do eventually decide to move on from DeBoer after 2 years or less. On a 4th-and-1 with 9:09 remaining, Florida State opted to go for it on their own 34-yard line in a one-score game. Then, Roydell Williams, an Alabama transfer, ran through Crimson Tide linebacker Deontay Lawson for the first down. The Seminoles then drove for the put-away touchdown in a 31-17 victory. Florida State, a two-win team from last season and two TD underdog to start this season, dropped the Crimson Tide back to the Mike Shula era. The Seminoles stormed the field, and not because Alabama was number one. The Crimson Tide were ranked number eight. Will DeBoer get fired, following in the footsteps of a legend? This is a monumental task DeBoer took on when he left Washington after leading the Huskies 25-3 record and CFP championship appearance in two seasons. Nick Saban casts a massive, massive shadow, and there's nothing DeBoer can do about it. Alabama quarterback Ty Simpson was inconsistent, barely completing 50% of his passes and fleeing from the pocket much of the day. Dating back to last season, Alabama has lost four of its last five road regular season games, averaging just 18 points per game in those losses. Saban had six road losses total in the CFP era from 2014 to 2023. The Tide will face number 5 Georgia, a potent Missouri team, number 13 South Carolina, and Auburn in SEC play. Will DeBoer have 6 road losses by the end of his second season? It certainly looks possible. Lastly, ask yourself a question. Thomas Castellanos turned Tommy Castellanos, a Boston College transfer, called out Alabama this summer, then, quote, ate the W, unquote, afterward. Would that have ever happened with Saban on the sidelines? Then again, there is a buyout. Here is a look at the other classic overreactions from week one. Need perspective? Look at the same thoughts from last season. Arch Manning is overrated. There is no sugarcoating Manning had a rough day at number 3 Ohio State on Saturday in a 14-7 loss. Manning was 17 of 30 for 170 yards, a TD, and an interception in a disjointed full-time debut. The good news? He knows it was bad. If you want to compare him to Uncles Peyton and Eli, then listen to his press conference. Manning held himself accountable, didn't blame anybody but himself, and promised improvement. Will the Longhorns bounce back? They're a good team, but I thought we beat ourselves a lot, and that starts with me, Manning said. Let's just be honest. Manning is a victim of our media and social media hype. The 5-star quarterback is expected to win the Heisman Trophy, SEC Championship, and National Championship based on his last name for our pleasure. Peyton went through that at Tennessee from 1994 to 1997. Manning's first start against a top 10 team was against number 10 Alabama on October 15, 1994. Manning finished 10 of 18 for 138 yards and 2 interceptions in a 17-13 loss. He probably heard the same things Arch is hearing now. The good news, Texas displayed a nasty defense that limited Ohio State to 203 yards, and the Longhorns did have a chance to tie the game in the final minutes. Manning's lone TD pass, a 32-yard dime to Parker Livingstone, offered a hint of that true talent. Brian Kelly is a savior of the SEC. On a day where Alabama and Texas lost, number 9 LSU pulled out a 17-10 victory at number 4 Clemson in the Battle of Death Valley. That should take a considerable amount of heat off Brian Kelly, knowing LSU had not won an opener since 2019. LSU still had moments of frustration, including 2 first-half fumbles, the second coming on a botched sequence near the end of the first half. Clemson led 10-3 at halftime. Garrett Nussmeier, 28 of 38, 230 yards with a touchdown, out-dueled Cade Klubnik, 19 of 38, 230 yards with an interception. But the new headline with LSU is the defense. LSU's All-American linebackers Harold Perkins and Whit Weeks were amazing. Second-year defensive coordinator Blake Baker has a legit defense infused by transfers, and it shows. Clemson had 2 drives of more than 3 plays in the second half. He will be a name to watch this offseason as head coach openings emerge. It ended with a 4th-and-4 with 104 remaining with Clemson on the LSU 11-yard line, and Perkins pressured Klubnik into an incompletion. Give Kelly credit. LSU was 4-8 against ranked teams coming into a game against Clemson, where it would have been easy to tee off on the embattled coach in his 4th season. Now, LSU will be, at minimum, the 3rd highest-ranked team behind number 5 Georgia and Texas, depending on where the Longhorns fall. LSU will play 6 ranked teams in SEC play, so there is a long way to go. Michigan is a playoff team with Bryce Underwood. It looked like it for a quarter. Michigan ranked 131st in the FBS in pass offense with 129.1 yards per game last season. 5-star freshman Bryce Underwood had 147 yards in a TD by halftime in a 34-17 victory against New Mexico. He finished 21 of 31 for 251 yards and 1 TD in a mostly impressive debut. Justice Haynes, an Alabama transfer, added 159 rushing yards and 3 TDs. Michigan looks different on offense under second-year coach Sherrone Moore. It looked like the Jim Harbaugh era with tempo under new offensive coordinator Chip Lindsey. Pair that with second-year coordinator Wink Martindale, and the Wolverines might have something. Underwood is the key. He hit 5 of 6 passes for 55 yards in his first two drives and went 5 of 5 for 68 yards in a TD in the two-minute drill to end the half. There will be ups and downs with the freshman quarterback, but the arm talent is real. Will the decision-making follow? New Mexico trimmed the lead to 17-10 in the first half. This still felt different than a sloppy opener against Fresno State last season. Michigan won 8 games and closed last season with victories against Ohio State and Michigan State without a collegiate-level passing game. The Wolverines might just be the fourth wheel in the Big Ten with the Buckeyes, number 2 Penn State, and number 7 Oregon. That could be the strongest four-team combination in the Power Four, and Michigan does not play the Nittany Lions or Ducks this season. Michigan's trip to Oklahoma will be a huge challenge. The Sooners have a new quarterback, too, in John Mateer. The Washington State transfer had 392 passing yards, 24 rushing yards, and 4 total TDs in a 35-3 blowout against Illinois State. The winner there will be a top 10 team. The U is back and ready to win the ACC. Number 10 Miami beat number 6 Notre Dame 27-24 on Sunday in a statement victory for Mario Cristobal and quarterback Carson Beck. The Georgia transfer, who hit 20 of 31 passes for 205 yards in a TD. The Hurricanes flashed first-round talent on both sides of the ball in the trenches, including tackle Francis Magoa and edge rusher Reuben Bain Jr. For Cristobal, this is his best victory as a head coach since leading number 12 Oregon to a 35-28 victory at number 3 Ohio State on September 11, 2021. The Ducks hung around in the top 10 before 2 losses to Utah in the Pac-12. Miami will at minimum do the same in the ACC. Beck, a 6-year transfer who is now 25-3 as a starter, fits into Miami fit offense. Beck was 14 of 17 on passes of less than 20 yards and 2 of 6 on passes of 20 yards or more. Both of those deep passes were end zone shots that resulted in TDs. Does this mean we can make that declaration again? Miami won 10 games, just missed the CFP last season. Miami plays Bethune-Cookman in Week 2 before an in-state tour that includes South Florida, September 13th, number 15 Florida on September 20th, and a resurgent Florida State on October the 4th. Then the ACC schedules heat up. We have maintained that the stance that we will believe the U is back when they win their first ACC championship. This could be the year. The Bill Belichick era at UNC is a disaster. The debut qualifies as a disaster. TCU routed North Carolina 48-14 in Belichick's long-awaited debut, which strayed from the script after the Tar Heels scored on the opening drive. TCU rushed for 258 yards on 7.7 yards per carry. North Carolina committed 3 turnovers, and Sonny Dyke said afterward the Horned Frogs felt disrespected. This was the difference between a team that will compete for the Big 12 championship and another that might need more than half a season to figure it out with 70 transfers. Belichick will need to start at quarterback. Gio Lopez, 4 of 10 with 69 yards and 1 interception, struggled, and backup Max Johnson, 9 of 11, 103 yards and a touchdown, played well in the fourth quarter. This isn't exactly Drew Bledsoe-Tom Brady by any stretch, but it could help in games against Charlotte and Richmond. Anything to help a poor 1 of 10 conversion rate on third down. Belichick has created excitement and a star-studded crowd that featured Michael Jordan, Lawrence Taylor, Mia Hamm, and Roy Williams was cool to see. That said, there is a lot of work to be done in Chapel Hill, and the 73-year-old Belichick faces a huge uphill climb to toward ACC contention this year. Some quick hits. Adding to Alabama's misery, a look at former Crimson Tide quarterbacks in week one. Julian Sayin, Ohio State, 13 of 20, 126 yards, and a TD in a 14-7 win against number one Texas. Eli Holstein, Pitt, 15 of 23, 215 yards, four TDs in a 61-9 victory against Duquesne. Dylan Lonergan, Boston College, 26 of 34 for 268 yards and four TDs in a 66-10 win against Fordham. Georgia's Gunnar Stockton did his best Stetson Bennett impersonation with 190 passing yards and two TDs in 73 rushing yards and two TDs in a 45-70 victory against Marshall. Arkansas quarterback Taylen Green had 322 yards and six TDs in a 52-7 victory against Alabama A&M. The Razorbacks face Arkansas State before a date with number 21 Ole Miss on September 13th. Tulane beat Northwestern 23-3. BYU transfer Jake Retzlaff had 152 passing yards, 113 rushing yards, and two total TDs. Navy beat VMI 52-7. The Green Wave and Midshipmen are the leading CFP candidates from the CFP after week one, but keep an eye on South Florida, too, after a 34-7 win against number 25 Boise State. The American Conference race will be fun. West Virginia beat Robert Morris 45-3 in Rich Rodriguez's return. The Mountaineers travel to Ohio in week two before the backyard brawl. In a story by Douglas Santo, Notre Dame lost its opener to Miami, but Marcus Freeman's post-game speech won everyone over. Notre Dame opened its 2025 season with a close 27-24 loss on the road to number 10 Miami. The Fighting Irish fell behind 21-7 heading into the fourth quarter and then came back to tie the game. However, after scoring the game-tying touchdown with just over 3 minutes left in the game, Miami drove down for a field goal to take the lead with just over 1 minute remaining. The Fighting Irish couldn't respond, and the Hurricanes held on for the season-opening victory. Although Notre Dame lost the game, head coach Marcus Freeman delivered a post-game speech that has the fan base ready to run through a brick wall to support his Fighting Irish. Notre Dame football posted Freeman's speech on social media, and here's the transcript. I don't care if you didn't play a snap or you played every down. I don't care if you're a coordinator, if you're a position coach, or if you're a graduate assistant. It doesn't matter. Everybody points the finger at themselves and say, what could we have done to make sure that we achieve the outcome that we want? And that's what we'll do, right? Stay together. We got the best leadership, and this is when leadership has to show, right? Keep us together. We got to go to work. I'm not saying continue to do the same. We got to find different ways and better ways of doing it. We can't beat Notre Dame. And we know there was plays in that game where we beat Notre Dame. Credit to them. It's a good team. Top 10 battle. We lost by three. Okay, we lost by three. The first game of the season, right? We got a good ball team. I sat there and watched. I said, okay, we had to go through a little bit of the bumps in the road, but we got a good ball team. We got to get back to work, right? This taste of pain, it hurts. The embarrassment, okay, we got to use this as we go back to work. We're going to go back to work, right? Stay together, man. With Notre Dame's loss to number 10 Miami, the Fighting Irish likely need to win out to make the college football playoffs. Being an independent school, Notre Dame would have to earn an at-large bid into the playoffs. However, after Freeman's speech, he has fans believing in the future of the 2025 season. Whether it's Fighting Irish fans backing their team and head coach or Freeman earning critics' respect, his speech touched almost everyone who heard it. Notre Dame has a chance to bounce back on Saturday, September 13th against Texas A&M in its home opener. You're listening to Sports on Sight into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight into Sound on HD4 on 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as your smart speaker. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. Moving over to Major League Baseball, Griffin Goodwin writes, Juan Soto responds to hecklers after Mets series opening win over Tigers. It's one of the most common sounds one will hear at a ballpark, and it happens most frequently whenever a star player comes up to bat. That's when fans began to chant the word overrated, or maybe overrated, which is sometimes followed by a series of five claps. No player is spared from these chants. The higher their profile, the more likely they'll hear them, especially if they're in the midst of a slump. New York Mets outfielder Juan Soto doesn't find himself in that latter category of superstar as he headed into Monday's series opener against the Detroit Tigers with hits in seven of his last eight games. But the sound of those four syllables still reverberated throughout Comerica Park, just like they have everywhere Soto has played this season. Rather than blast those fans in a social media tirade or a fiery post-game comment, Soto let his play on the diamond do the talking. Soto went 2-for-3 at the plate with two walks in the Mets' 10-8 win over the Tigers, scoring two runs himself and driving in six more, which tied his single-game career high in that statistic. He also became the first player in modern professional baseball history to launch a go-ahead grand slam and a go-ahead multiple run triple in the same contest, according to Optostats. It's a show, Mets manager Carlos Mendoza told reporters after the game via The Athletic's Will Salmon. Every time he's at the plate, you want to watch it. It's pretty special, and I'm glad he's on our team. Soto didn't directly address the chants he had been hearing in his own post-game interview, but he did share why individual performances like this one are so important for the Mets as they chase a National League playoff spot. This is the month, Soto said via The Athletic's Will Salmon. I feel like whoever gets hot in September is the team that goes all the way. Compared to previous seasons, Soto is having a slightly down year as he is hitting just .257 at the plate, projected to be his lowest single-season mark in a year he spent with only one team. Yet he has still been productive in his first campaign with the Mets, swatting 36 home runs, accumulating 90 RBIs, and leading the league in walks with 113, which has brought his OPS up to .915. Christopher Damon writes, Astros won't like this Alex Bregman free agent prediction. The Houston Astros received a bad prediction on one of their potential offseason targets from Bleacher Report's Tim Kelly, whose recent article predicts the landing spot of each MLB team's top free agent this winter. All-star third baseman Alex Bregman signed a 3-year, $120 million contract with the Boston Red Sox last offseason. But with his stellar play this season, he's likely to opt out of the last 2 years of his deal and hit the open market. While Kelly knows there will be several suitors for Bregman, he ultimately predicts the 10-year Major League veteran will re-sign with the Red Sox this winter. Here's part of Kelly's reasoning for his prediction. But for as much as it feels like the Red Sox almost have too much position talent, they moved on from Rafael Devers, and manager Alex Cora has a long-standing relationship with Bregman dating back to their time in Houston, he writes. There will be other suitors, but the Red Sox should be seen as the favorite for Bregman. Bregman is having his best season in years, slashing .286, .370, .494, with 16 home runs and 53 RBI over 93 games. He made his first All-Star team this year since 2019, and is still a solid defender at third base. Plus, he's a two-time World Series champion whose veteran presence could be helpful for years to come as Boston's young core continues to develop. But Bregman did spend the first 9 seasons of his career with the Astros. If Houston offers him enough money, would he be willing to return? Astros fans will have to wait and see if Kelly's prediction is correct. In an article by T.J. French, it might take years for the St. Louis Cardinals' attendance numbers to rebound. The 2025 season isn't totally lost for the St. Louis Cardinals, but the fans seem to be out on this year's team, and it has reflected in their attendance numbers. The Cardinals are 3 games below 500 at 68-71, but the Cincinnati Reds seem to be headed in the wrong direction, and the Cardinals are just 5.5 games back of the final wildcard spot. Now, is it a tough hill to climb over the final month of the season? Yes, but it's certainly been done before, as baseball can be a funky sport in its last month of the regular season. Cardinals fans are historically one of the best groups in all of Major League Baseball, but the 2025 season marks the lowest average attendance since 2021, and it's been 4 straight seasons of average attendance dips. Thus far throughout the season, Busch Stadium has averaged 28,165 attendees per home game, down 7,000 from 2024 and down 12,000 from the 2023 season. That 28,165 attendees per game is good for the 19th best mark in MLB. Compared to the 2023 season, those 40,000-plus fans per home game rank 4th best in MLB. The Cardinals didn't even make the playoffs in 2023 and haven't played an October game since 2022 when they were knocked out in the wild card round by the Philadelphia Phillies. The bad news for Busch Stadium is that there may be another strike on the horizon in Major League Baseball, which may hinder the Cardinals' home attendance in years to come. Paired with the fact that the front office expects to enter a rebuild 2026 season with Chaim Bloom as the new president of baseball operations. St. Louis is trending in the wrong direction in terms of attendance, and if the performance on the field doesn't improve, the Cardinal fans will continue to be absent. Billy Hyen writes, Yankees make surprise Giancarlo Stanton decision 3 days after Aaron Boone said he wouldn't do this. Aaron Boone can't make up his mind. The New York Yankees manager has quickly reversed the decision he made about Giancarlo Stanton. The Yanks are heading to Houston to play the Astros, and Boone was asked over the weekend if Stanton would potentially play left field in the series. No, I don't have plans on playing him in left there, Boone told reporters. 3 days later, the tone changed. Boone revealed Tuesday morning that Stanton would start in left field on Tuesday night, according to John Boy Media. It's a tricky situation, so it's possible Boone really did just decide he needed to flip-flop on this, or there's a chance the directive came from above Boone. Left field is by far the smallest part of the outfield in Houston, which could help Stanton given his limited mobility. It's also tricky, though, because those Crawford boxes jut out into the field of play. Just recently, Angels outfielder Taylor Ward collided hard with a metal part of the wall out there and was hurt. Stanton has to keep playing the field because his bat is on fire and Aaron Judge is still the everyday DH. Judge has been attempting to get his right elbow back in shape to return to the field, but it clearly isn't ready yet. That leaves the Yankees hoping Stanton can get the job done just well enough to make it worthwhile to have his bat in the lineup. Stanton last played left field on September 14, 2023, but nearly 2 years later, he's heading back out there again in a plan that seemed to have been rejected, but now is being put into action. Going up to the Motor City, Matt Sullivan writes, Tigers' dominant August bullpen might be a mirage, according to an insider. The Detroit Tigers made a lot of moves at the trade deadline, all of which involved pitchers in some capacity. Charlie Morton and Chris Paddock were starters, but the rest of the additions were in the bullpen. Kyle Finnegan has been dominant for the Tigers, while Rafael Montero, Cody Hewer, and Paul Sewald make up the other Tigers bullpen additions. They join Brent Herter, Will Vest, Tyler Holton, Brennan Hanafy, Troy Melton, Chase Lee, Alex Lang, Bo Brisk, John Brebbia, and Tommy Conley in the Tigers' deep bullpen. They have plenty of other options aside from those relievers, making up a deep bullpen which finished August with a 2.89 ERA, second best in the major leagues. But according to MLB insider Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic, this strong August is a bit deceptive. While the Tigers had a good August from their bullpen, there are still two statistics that are of concern for the Tigers heading into the final month of the regular season and eventually the postseason. Still, Rosenthal writes, the bullpen entered Monday ranked next to last in strikeout rate, a lingering concern. This concern is something that could derail the Tigers' bullpen in October. Getting strikeouts in the postseason is a huge boost for a team, especially since if they can't strike batters out, there are more chances for hits and errors in the field. Consider the Pens' performance in August, Rosenthal writes. While it ranked second in ERA and third in opponents' OPS, those numbers were deceptive. More telling, the bullpen ranked 25th in fielding independent pitching for the month, and its opponents' 219 batting average on balls in play was by far the lowest in the league. FIP is a measure to determine how pitching actually pans out if balls in play aren't counted. While there are times when a poor defense can make a team's FIP lower than its ERA, in the Tigers' case, it's the opposite. Detroit's bullpen isn't striking out many batters, and while they've gotten by in August, no guarantee that come October, the bullpen will get as lucky as they did in August. It's a big concern if Rosenthal's fears come true, as the Tigers, despite their plethora of bullpen moves, could be in a position with a shaky bullpen when it matters most. While Detroit's bullpen has certainly been better as of late, the lack of strikeouts and luck on batted balls in play might turn the opposite direction, which could make the Tigers' elite August bullpen look like a mirage. Moving out to the West Coast, Christopher Damon writes how the Padres are bringing back Martin Maldonado on a minor league deal weeks after his release. The San Diego Padres have re-signed catcher Martin Maldonado to a minor league deal, per Jeff Sanders of the San Diego Union-Tribune. The deal became official on August 31st, meaning Maldonado is eligible to be on the postseason roster as an injury replacement for either Freddie Freeman or Elias Diaz. Maldonado, a 15-year Major League veteran, was designated for assignment and then released by San Diego earlier this month. He'll report to the Padres' Arizona complex in Peoria via Sanders. With the Padres a near lock to make the postseason, Maldonado gives San Diego more depth at catcher this October. If he needs to step in, Maldonado has plenty of postseason experience. He made 11 starts at catcher during the Houston Astros 2022 World Series run. San Diego still has Luis Campusano on the 40-man roster, but it didn't recall him with the extra active roster spot that opened up on September 1st. They instead held on to a pair of utility infielders, Will Wagner and Mason McCoy. Here's how Anthony Franco of MLB Trade Rumors analyzes the move. Maldonado is at least familiar with San Diego's pitching staff if he's pressed into action. His offensive shortcomings are well known, and he was hitting 204, 245, 327 in 161 plate appearances this year. But despite Maldonado's weaknesses, he also ranks second in MLB with 8 passed balls. Franco writes that the Padres still seem to prefer him as their third option at catcher over Campusano. San Diego, with a record of 76-62, continues its series versus the Baltimore Orioles, who are 62-76 tonight at Petco Park. Going over to Beantown, Billy Hyen writes, Red Sox shortstop Trevor Story hit one of the weirdest home runs in MLB history. There have been few home runs ever hit as weird as the one that Boston Red Sox shortstop Trevor Story hit on Monday against the Cleveland Guardians. It all starts with pesky pole, that overly close to home plate right field foul pole in Fenway Park. Story lofted a fly ball that was a heat-seeking missile heading almost directly at pesky pole. Guardians right fielder Junkinsey Noel hustled that way. The outfielder, affectionately known as Big Christmas, closed in right as the ball was descending in front of the foul pole. Initially, Noel appeared to catch the baseball in his glove, but upon review, the ball appeared to have squirted out the top of the glove just for a moment at a crucial point in time. Right as Noel crossed by the foul pole is when the ball popped out. And when it popped out, it nicked the foul pole. A batted ball that hits the foul pole is a home run. This batted ball hit the foul pole, thus home run. We've seen home runs that go over the fence with an assist from a glove or a player's body part. But the tiniest of assists to hit the foul pole, that one might be new. It's a tough break for Cleveland and Noel, and a great bit of luck for Story. Baseball always gives us something we've never seen before. In another story by Billy Hyen, Rafael Devers set San Francisco Giants record with laser home run. Rafael Devers has finally heated up. The San Francisco Giants' blockbuster trade acquisition from earlier in the season took a while, and in the process, the Giants' climb toward the postseason got a lot tougher. But of late, the former Boston Red Sox star is on fire. Devers hit 9 home runs in August, and he didn't waste time in September. On Labor Day, which was the first day of the new month, Devers homered again. This one was in Coors Field, and it set a new Giants record. StatCast first started tracking exit velocities in 2015, and since then, no Giants player has hit a home run harder than Devers hit his on Monday, 114.5 miles an hour. Sarah Langs of MLB Network provided the statistic. It was pretty much a laser down the right field line that Devers turned on with quite the authority. It'll be a long time before the Red Sox decision to trade Devers to the Giants can be fully assessed, but it doesn't take long to realize Devers can still really, really hit. The bat is special, and San Francisco should reap the benefits of that for a long time to come. K.D. Jane writes, Padres' Luis Urias reaches major career milestone with important hit. On Monday, San Diego's Padres slugger Luis Urias reached a major milestone after registering his 1,000th career hit during the game against the Baltimore Orioles. In the seventh inning, Urias squared up the breaking ball, dissecting the middle infield for a base hit to kickstart the offense as the team trailed 4-3. This was Arias' third hit in the game, as he also capitalized on the previous two plate appearances while driving in a run. Arias' hit prompted the Orioles to replace Dietrich Enns with Rico Garcia. The Padres couldn't capitalize on Arias' one-out single as Manny Machado lined out to left field while Ryan O'Hearn struck out swinging to end the inning. Arias hit a sacrifice bunt to Enns in the fifth inning to advance Freddie Freeman to second. The Padres' catcher would come around to score on Roman Laureano's RBI single to tie the game. Earlier in the game, Arias drove in Jake Cronenworth with an RBI single in the second inning. He started the ball game with a hit as well. While Luis Urias may have achieved a major milestone, he's in a slump. He had a challenging August, hitting just .233 with a .577 OPS. This has led to questions being raised regarding his spot in the lineup. I'm a human, Urias said prior to Wednesday's game. Every player has a bad year, bad weeks, bad months. I just try to work hard every day, do the little things to help the team win. The good thing is we're winning. Padres manager Mike Schilt gave Arias a much-needed day off last week after he nearly played every inning of August despite his slump. During his absence, trade deadline acquisition Ramon Laureano logged time in the number two spot. Moving over to Houston, Aaron Rayleigh writes, "How impactful has Carlos Correa been since his return to Houston?" As the time was running out in the 2025 MLB trade deadline, the Houston Astros made a move sure to make the fans happy, bringing former shortstop Carlos Correa back to Space City to cover third base duties. And it's actually worked out for the franchise, helping the team stay competitive in addition to this likely being a feel-good trade for the team. But how does Correa compare to the rest of the trade deadline acquisitions across the league? Brian Murphy ranked Correa the third best deadline acquisition in 2025. According to MLB.com analyst Brian Murphy, Carlos Correa was the third best acquisition of the 2025 trade deadline a month after the deals went down. Correa rejoining the Astros was the deadline's biggest shocker, Murphy wrote. Less surprising is how well he is playing in the city where he began his career. Correa picked up 30 hits through the first 22 games of this reunion and owns a .320, .389, .443 slash line in 108 plate appearances. His 137 WRC plus is a 40-point leap from what he accomplished with the Twins, and his .9 Fangraphs WAR in just 25 games with the Astros nearly matches his 1.0 F WAR in 93 games with Minnesota this season. The Astros still hold a narrow lead in the American League West with just a month left in the regular season, with the Seattle Mariners and Texas Rangers still hanging tight in the division. Staying in Houston, Mac Baltz writes, "What Luis Garcia's impressive debut means for the Astros." Luis Garcia, who recently was reinstated from the 60-day injured list, impressed in his season debut for the Astros today. This marked his first MLB appearance since 2023 after rehabbing from Tommy John surgery. Garcia went six innings, surrendering three hits and three runs. Garcia struck out six and showed great control and did not issue a walk. Apart from three runs via two home runs, Garcia had a great outing, earning himself a quality start and leaving the game in line for the win behind five runs from the Astros' offense, a much-needed result for an Astros squad that has lost four out of their last seven games. Astros fans will also be encouraged to see Garcia's pitch count at 79, fully stretched out and ready to go deep in games after rejoining the rotation. After losing Ronel Blanco for the season due to a right elbow injury, Garcia's activation couldn't have come at a better time. And now, heading into the postseason, Houston will have a very talented four-man rotation, headlined by Cy Young Award candidate Hunter Brown and left-handed ace Framber Valdez. Luis Garcia will join Christian Javier at the back end of a postseason rotation. Javier, like Garcia, also just returned from injury. Both of these players were vital pieces to the Astros' 2022 championship team and may be expected to play an even larger role this October. If they're able to make the postseason roster, struggling starters Lance McCullers Jr., Spencer Arrighetti, and Jason Alexander are likely to be moved to the bullpen. Moving over to Jacksonville, David Suggs writes a story about the Trevor Lawrence family tree. Billed as one of the greatest QB prospects in recent memory, Trevor Lawrence's career hasn't quite gone to plan thus far. On one hand, the Jaguars signal caller is undoubtedly one of the greatest passers to ever call Jacksonville home. On the other hand, Jacksonville's lack of sustained success makes such a label a bit less prestigious. Still, the Clemson alum has plenty of time to right the ship. The Jaguars have added a few shiny pieces into their collection in recent seasons to partner with Lawrence. And with millions left on his current deal, it's as good a time as ever for Lawrence to assert himself as one of the league's better hurlers. We've been made privy to Lawrence's on-the-field highlights and lowlights over the years, but what does life look like for Lawrence when he takes off his helmet? Here's what you need to know about Lawrence's family tree. Lawrence is married to Marissa Lawrence, born Marissa Mowry. The couple wed in 2021 following a five-year courtship. Also a Cartersville native and a Cartersville High School alum, Marissa played soccer at Anderson University, a Division II school in Anderson, South Carolina. She was but a 30-minute drive from Lawrence's Clemson digs, making it that much easier to maintain their romance with one another. Lawrence proposed to Marissa on the Clemson Memorial Stadium grass, with the former donning a simple navy blue suit and the latter outfitted in a patterned white dress and black heels. Marissa Lawrence gave birth to she and Lawrence's first child in January 2025, welcoming daughter Shay Lynn to the world. She was decked out in a knitted pink sweater that featured her name in cursive. "Mommy and Daddy love you so much. Thank you, Jesus, for our girl," Marissa Lawrence wrote on Instagram. Lawrence's father is Jeremy Lawrence. Standing a hulking 6'6", Jeremy's haunting frame could explain why his son towers over opposition defenders. That's not where the similarities end for Lawrence and his father, who worked as a manager at a steel company during Lawrence and his siblings' childhoods. Lawrence is renowned for his calm disposition on and off the field. His mother, Amanda, believes it's a trait that came from his father. Trev really has an uncanny, just calmness about him. Even in the midst of very intense circumstances or situations, Trevor's got a pretty level head, and he's been able to handle that, Amanda Lawrence told the Post and Courier in 2018. My husband is really like that, too. He probably gets that from his dad. He's just calm, cool, and collected. Jeremy Lawrence has been a beacon in his children's lives, embracing their passions, even if he doesn't know too much about them. Art, not sports, entranced Lawrence's brother, Chase, and no artist captured his imagination more than freelancer and comics creator Alex Pardee. When Pardee did a gallery showing in Atlanta, Chase wanted to go. So the two loaded up in Jeremy Lawrence's car, made a beeline for the exhibit, and met Pardee. All these years later, Chase is a professional artist. He credited his father with pushing him to pursue his passions. My dad doesn't know anything about art, and I know the whole time he was like, this is so weird, but he did it for one reason, to support me, Chase Lawrence told ESPN in 2021. I had so many questions for Pardee. I showed him my drawings, and he asked if he could have one, so we traded drawings. I still have his at my parents' house. Lawrence's mother is Amanda Lawrence. She's an ear, nose, and throat nurse practitioner, having performed dutifully in the role for more than a decade. Like her husband, Amanda has supported Lawrence throughout his gridiron career. She's frequented Trevor's contest since he was a child, traveling from South Carolina to London to witness the hulking sidewinder connect with receivers. She remembers his first interactions with athletics, playing on a soccer team as a five-year-old. His potential shone through during those days, too. He would just get the ball and score, Amanda said on the Move the Sticks podcast per 24/7 Sports. Finally, the coach of the other team was like, listen, you've got to take him out because he's just making all the goals. It was on a rec team, a church league team, so they really didn't keep score that much anyway. But every time the ball was tapped, Trevor would go get it and go score. And they're like, okay, you've got to take him out. Lawrence's brother is Chase Lawrence, an artist who, alongside his wife, Brooke, have crafted high-profile pieces, some of which feature Lawrence himself. Despite their diverging careers, the Lawrence brothers are best friends, according to Brooke Lawrence. Chase is the elder brother, a Pardee acolyte known for his use of color, Baroque stylings, and passion for oil painting. I was a wild child. Trevor was the one who was always good at sports, Chase said. We knew he was going to get a full ride somewhere for something since he was in middle school. My whole family loved sports so much, but at the time, I couldn't have cared less. Lawrence's parents were concerned that Chase and Trevor wouldn't be close. Chase is 5 years Trevor's junior, a gap Jeremy and Amanda Lawrence feared would be too large to build a close-knit relationship. As it turned out, the opposite was true. The first time Chase drove without his parents' supervision was when he took him and Trevor to the hospital to meet their younger sister after she was born. Not only are Chase and Trevor close as siblings can be, they're also collaborators. Lawrence has served as Chase's muse on multiple occasions. In 2021, Trevor inked an exclusive deal with Topps to produce 50 trading cards. 20 of those cards featured Chase and Brooks' artwork. Trevor also served as a model for Golgotha, Hill of the Skull, an oil painting by Chase and Brooke. Chase and Brooke are extremely talented artists, and it's special to collaborate with them, Trevor said. Lawrence's sister is Olivia Lawrence. She's far younger than her older brothers, having been born when Trevor was in middle school. Not much is known about Olivia, but according to People, she's an accomplished volleyball player in Georgia. Lawrence hails from Cartersville, Georgia, a small town located on the northwest tip of the Atlanta metropolitan area. Lawrence was born in Knoxville, Tennessee, and lived there until the age of 6 before moving to Cartersville, which claims former NFL running backs Ronnie Brown and Keith Henderson as former residents. Lawrence found himself atop the athletic surfaces that painted the township's landscapes. He was a two-sport star at Cartersville High School, earning the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Player of the Year honors after collecting 3,655 yards and 51 passing touchdowns as a junior in 2016, following a sterling senior campaign that saw him shatter Deshaun Watson's Georgia State records in passing yards and touchdowns across a career and land a state title. Lawrence enrolled at Clemson. We've come to the end of our program. I've been reading sports from the Sporting News. I'm Alan Lai, and this has been a production of Sight Into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.